Everyone, and welcome back to the Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartlebaugh, and I'm joined with Seth Dombach. Seth, how are you doing?
Doing great, Nathan.
And we are here for the second part of the Twin Peaks series that we're doing for Twin Peaks The Return. And the first episode, we were pretty ambitious. We thought we were going to be able to cover the first six episodes, and we kind of went back, talked about the original series, and we got through about 2.5 episodes there, and it's kind of folly to try and explain everything that's happening. We're not going to be doing that. What I really want to talk about going forward, we're going to cover episodes really probably, I don't know how far we'll get here, but we're going to try to cover going forward the episodes more in terms of theme and plot. One of the things is, as we catch up, once we've caught up, we'll probably try to keep it up at like about 2 episodes at a time. Right now we're still trying to gain ground on that. So instead of talking about everything as it happens in an episode, one of the reasons for that being it's hard to keep track of everything that Lynch has going on. Yes. And at this point, it's hard for you to remember what happens in an individual episode, primarily because Twin Peaks The Return has such a fluid sort of feel to it. It feels like one long movie. It doesn't really feel like a episodic show. It's not episodic like the original was. So, and also because I think it's more important to talk about these things in terms of themes and sort of about how we're reacting to it instead of chronologically, because in a lot of ways chronology doesn't matter so much. I think it only matters in the sense of what do we know at a given time and how does that affect how we the impact of a scene. Right. Because I think mostly Lynch is after how are you impacted by a scene. So Seth, before we kind of really get diving in here in a general way, because we talked about how our first impressions of the show, starting with episode 3, we really have what we could consider, I guess, the beginning of the return of Agent Cooper.
Yeah.
How do you feel that handled, or that has been handled so far, from episodes 3 through 7? Give me your feelings on how are you feeling about that.
I wasn't sure on how to feel about it at first. The whole situation with Dougie Jones being kind of like a cipher or some kind of construct created by Evil Bob or the doppelganger for Cooper. But as it's gone along, I'm really in love with what Lynch is doing with it so far. You know, because at first I thought, everybody was like, you want Cooper to come back. You can't wait for Cooper to come back. But I like the fact that there is anticipation. Because you think about, Cooper's been in the Black Lodge for 25 years. When you come out of a place like that, you're not just going to be automatically, right back into your normal self again. It's going to take time to get back to that. And I like the way that Lynch is slowly building over time, that, he's starting to get pieces of himself back. It's not just a quick, I almost thought at first, he's gonna have a sip of coffee and then it's gonna like trigger all these memories of who he was, and that didn't happen, which I think is smart on Lynch's part, because if we just get it all at once like that, it doesn't make sense to he's just snapping back into himself. It's going to take him time to get back to remembering who he is. And slowly over the episodes since he, came into the body of Dougie Jones, you've been getting slow hints at that, because he started off wearing Dougie's clothes, like the lime green suit, and now he's back to wearing the black suit again. He's picking up on things like badges, and just in the most recent episode, he was able to disarm somebody really quickly. So we're starting to see Cooper become Cooper again, but I love this slow progression and the way that other people are reacting to him in this way. So I think I really enjoy with what Lynch is doing. I feel like we're probably going to get Cooper back within at least the next like 2 or 3 episodes.
I Yes, I really like what they're doing too. I honestly, there's a part of me that questions how quickly we will get him back. I'll go into that in a minute. Knowing Lynch, I almost wouldn't be surprised to see it take a much longer time to get the fully restored Cooper.
Yeah.
My thoughts on it are, I was a little surprised at first in A, how they did it in, and also how long it's taking, but I think that has a lot to do with expectations, which is the biggest
Right.
issue I think people have with Lynch, which is they have even when you have expectations, even when you think he's going to do something and he does exactly what you think he's going to do. I remember talking to my wife as the first episode was starting and giving some thoughts about what I always wanted to kind of see or what I thought would happen. And in a lot of ways, Lynch, it's weird to see Lynch hit every single one of those notes, but not in a way that like satisfied what I thought I wanted from the show at all.
Right.
That's not to say I
Right.
wasn't satisfied ultimately, but let's for a moment look at specifically how he does come back. Because when we last talked, we talked a lot about that fantastic dream sequence that opens the
Right.
episode. And while I said I don't want to talk about the episodes in terms of like what happens in each one, I will say it seems like Lynch always takes time in every single episode to have this moment where he allows a specific and intentional lull in some ways in the action, or where everything
Right.
slows down. In that episode specifically, it's really the dream sequence where things are
Yeah.
kind of slow, even though something is always happening in that dream sequence. And we talked about how at one point he sees the floating head of Don Davis,
Yeah.
who is Briggs. But what's interesting about that is, A, he's a disembodied head, which my first thought when I saw that was, we also have a body without a head. A hairy fat man's body
Yeah.
somewhere else, and that doesn't have a head and is inexplicable. And we hear Bobby Briggs talk about how, he was the last person to see my father alive, but we never find out what happened to
Right.
Briggs. We have no idea where he ended up exactly. At least we didn't in that at the point in time we're seeing this. And then so we see his disembodied head, which I'm like, okay, there's a floating head. We've got a body without a head. Is there a connection there? We also have him say the words "blue rose."
Right.
We didn't talk about. We mentioned that last episode, but we didn't really discuss what "blue rose" has been in the context of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And Seth, do you want to talk about that a little bit? I think "blue rose" first came up in Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me.
I believe it did, yeah. It's been quite a while since I've watched Fire Walk With Me, so I'm not sure of all the specifics around it. So I might have to toss that back to you for that, Nathan.
I don't remember everything, but I thought that Blue Rose was specifically a certain type of case file that Gordon Cole has, that he has these Blue Rose cases,
You're
almost
right,
not
yes.
unlike like an X-Files, but we're never
Yeah.
quite certain exactly what the unifying element is behind the Blue Rose cases. We don't know. It gives Cole a certain aspect of mystery and that you're not really certain. You know what he's doing here with the Blue Rose cases. There were a couple references to them, I think, in the return beyond that. But the
Yeah.
fact that Briggs is saying Blue Rose means that this is clearly going to have some sort of import down the way, in much the same way that the log lady saying, hey, something is missing and it's tied to your heritage here to
Yeah.
Hawk is going to have some kind of meaning. We can be pretty certain that when anytime Briggs says something, anytime the log lady's log says something, that they come as mystical sort of, hey, these are moments you need to latch on to.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they are just Lynch messing with us, I think. But so we have all that happen, and then the way he comes back, where he sort of, you've got Evil Cooper, who's been out of the lodge for 25 years and is clearly planned for this moment.
Yeah.
He kind of puts his hand over his mouth like he doesn't want to get sucked into the like cigarette lighter or something.
Yeah.
It seems to be there are different conduits for how you get pulled in and out of the Black Lodge if you don't
Yeah.
actually go physically looking for it. And so Ducky Jones gets sucked in like through the wall socket, I
Yeah.
think. And it's bizarre because we see him, he seems like a pretty like a sad sack of a human being, really.
Right.
He's here in this like abandoned house with a prostitute, while his wife and son across the, across town are looking for him and worried for him. And he just, we don't get to know him at all. I mean, no. We don't learn anything about him. He doesn't seem, at least in the moments we see him, like a character that would be that interesting to be around. He seems in every way, he's like a relative, I don't want to say normal guy, but just a kind of standard guy, you know?
Yeah.
There's nothing special, seemingly, about him.
But he honestly reminded me of the Gil character from The Simpsons. Like you said, like the sad sack, like insurance salesman kind of guy.
Right, exactly. He nothing about him strikes you as really all that interesting. So he's there, and he gets pulled into the Black Lodge, and there's this weird moment where Mike kind of recognizes, hey, something's up here. We've been tricked or hoodwinked or whatever, and he mentions you were designed for a purpose, and it's really about all we get to suggest that most likely Killer Bob or Bob Cooper or whatever you want to call him, has he or somebody on his behalf has constructed Dougie. And I'm not sure exactly how one does this.
Yeah, but it's like a manifestation of someone.
Which might be, we might be have less questions about it if we didn't learn that like Dougie actually has a family.
Right.
And like he was a part of something.
And he's obviously older than 25 years old.
And he's got a job, right. But, I mean, we've covered this kind of material or this kind of ground in, like, say, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where suddenly Buffy has a... spoilers, guys, for Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But at one point, Buffy has a sister who is in the fabric of reality, and everyone assumes and has memories of her as a 13-year-old girl. But in reality, monks took an orb of energy and, like, constructed it as a girl. So there's precedent for this sort of thing, I think, in fantasy fiction where, you know, all you have to do is distort the reality around things. Lynch is not the kind of guy that's going to come out and tell you any of that, though. He's not going to. Although we've had a little more exposition and explanation for things than I really expected we'd have, particularly in more recent episodes.
Yeah.
So we see Dougie get destroyed, basically annihilated, I guess. Like the air's let out of him in a sense. You know, he has a problem with his arm and it's all jacked up, and then like the smoke comes out of him. The part I want to talk about is, so when he's gone, there's a ring sitting on the seat where he was.
Yeah.
And do you remember what the role the ring played in Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me?
From what I remember of it, I think the ring appears to be, at least this is my interpretation of it, because it's never really told to you. It appears like the ring is something that is a way for you to not be possessed by one of the evil entities. Like that's at least what I think it is, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
That's the power that it's sort of given or mentioned in Fire Walk With Me, which is, I think Mike gives it to Laura Palmer as a way. It's not going to necessarily save her from being affected by him, but it will prevent her from being possessed by him in the same way that, say, Leland was possessed by him.
Right.
So that's interesting. So it seems to have some kind of power over that. But then the ring is the only thing that's left once Dougie is gone.
Yeah.
So there's this tradition in Twin Peaks of these sort of like sacred objects, if you will, you know, kind of mystical objects. The log, I guess, is a mystical object. The ring is a mystical object. It's weird because Cooper seems to almost be like now as Cooper's trying to get his memory back, he sees like, you know, the way he treats the badge is almost like a mystical object.
Right.
The chocolate bunnies are a mystical object at one point, like in that weird scene, which I believe happens in the same episode.
I think so.
As we are watching Cooper come back, and there's a lot of trial and error stuff with him. While that's happening, you have this other kind of trial and error going on where Hawk is trying to figure out what is missing. So he has, it goes on forever. And we were talking about this, how this is that dichotomy between the dark, the kind of dark and light. So you have the kind of weirdly mystical, beautiful things that happen. You have the really dark, gritty things that happen. Somewhere in the middle of all that, you have just weird, mundane, goofy humor things that happen. And the like people that are the primary providers of that are, for most of the part, are Andy the deputy and Lucy the secretary. Just downright silly stuff in some cases.
That entire scene is pretty much like Lynch's version of a fart joke.
The scene with the chocolate bunnies.
Yes.
So what do you think? I mean, knowing Lynch, and I don't want to be one of these people that sits there and says every scene's important, because the importance of some scenes is literally, I think, is just for Lynch to disarm you and give you a moment to just seep in what's already happened. Because if he keeps moving at the same pace, you're just going to be utterly confused. So you need a few moments just to sort of marinate in like what he's doing. I'm not certain, though, that that scene is one of them. I think that scene has some importance of some kind. I'm just not entirely clear what it is.
Yeah,
it's played in such a weird note. And I think it may even boil down to there's a scene where they're trying to figure it out, and they start talking about this package of chocolate bunnies. And Lucy admits that she ate one. And there's a whole story about a gas bubble, like you said. And then she's like, Andy looks and says, is it about the bunny? And Hawk stops and says, it's not about the bunnies. Then he pauses for a long time and then he says, is it about the bunnies?
Yeah.
And it's one of those moments where it's like, Roger Ebert always interpreted this as being like, this was Lynch's like way of cracking a joke and trying to make you not take everything so seriously. He might be right, but it's so smug. You would view it as kind of being smug and a little bit like self-effacing when he didn't want that from Lynch's work. And it's kind of mirroring your own questions as you watch it. Lynch, is this really what it's about? the evolution of the arm, really? Is that it? You know, the log, is it talking? What do the owls mean? And at the heart of it, though, he just has some very basic mystery questions. Like, the owls are not what they seem. Anyone else, all Lynch is really trying to say, I think, through that the owls are not what they seem, is, you know, the message to Cooper and to everyone else watching the show is things are not what they seem.
There is
a supernatural dimension here. Except it's such a cliche to say things are not what they seem. Right. Maybe the very first time anyone ever heard that in a story or a movie or an old detective novel, it might have been really, really compelling and knocked your socks off. The guy just said, things are not what they seem. Yeah. I can't believe my eyes. Like, but Lynch understands that that's just like, he wants you to connect to that same sentiment, but if he just says things are not what they seem, so he just throws in another word in a sense. He just throws in something you can visually grasp. The owls are not what they seem. There's some spooky imagery that comes with that statement, even though I think all he's really saying is these forces in nature that are playing around us are kind of observing us in shells or forms that look familiar.
Yeah.
And so a chocolate bunny could be the answer to the whole mystery. I'm not surprised if the chocolate bunny doesn't factor in some way.
Well, we remember, like, in the original episode, there's a scene where Cooper is, you know, when he's talking into his recorder, he says, Diane, I'm holding in my hands a box of chocolate bunnies, you know, like, out of nowhere. It's so random. And there's something weird about this where it's, like, they seem to remember Cooper, but some of the people in Twin Peaks don't seem to, like, recognize that he is one who's missing. Like, they don't understand that he's gone.
It's like almost like everyone's forgotten about him a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is weird for the people in the police station to have forgotten about him, I feel like that.
Yeah.
So, here's a theory. What if it ends up being that the moment that Agent Cooper fully regains his sensibilities is when he puts his hand on one of the chocolate bunnies?
Yeah.
And do you really think Lynch is above doing that? I do not.
No. I'm not gonna expect anything at this point. I'm just gonna let it happen.
I'm just saying that's possible.
Yeah,
the chocolate bunny may play a role. I don't think that the scene is as important for the chocolate bunnies, but just one of those weird, mundanely strange scenes that he elongates and lets it happen for a very long time. There's a lot of that happening in Twin Peaks where he does seem to be stopping, and he does seem to be referencing what the experience of watching Twin Peaks is, right down to the very most recent episode, episode 7, gives you a great deal of exposition. It really starts to bring in characters you recognize. It starts to tie the two disparate kind of sources we've had with Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, the original show, and then The Return and its own unique things it's doing. It starts to coalesce them together, and you're watching this and I'm suddenly like, oh, we've gotten so much information. And I started falling into that normal trap that happens when you watch a normal hour-long show. We're like, 10 minutes left, what are they going to do? What big surprise are they going to be able to get us? And I haven't felt that way watching the previous episodes because the pacing is such that it's just going along and I'm like, I have no expectation. But at this point, I was like, wow, he's got 10 more minutes. We could get Audrey Horne in here if we work really hard. And darn if he doesn't just stop and he gives us close to 7 minutes of a man sweeping a bunch of crap up into a pile. And he's like, look, here's what here's the visual, like, correlating image to what I just did for you. I spent time sweeping all the crap up for you. And you
with
just,
literally no payoff for that
payoff. Yes. So there's no payoff, because then what he does at the end of that scene is he introduces just some other aspect that makes my brain hurt, where we do reveal that the guy we've been talking about, the Renault guy, you know, who looks like a big beefy, like Dan Haggerty on a Twinkie binge. Yeah. Like he's there talking on the phone, and he reveals he's like, what is he? He's like Jean-Michel Renault or something like that. He's like a completely, he's played by the same actor who played the guy who earlier in this episode of The Return, we are reminded that Leland Palmer smothered to death with a pillow.
Yeah.
And yet here the same actor is. And then after that, we cut to a quick shot of the woods, an ominous shot of the woods. And then we're back in the diner with another scene that seems to be just taking its own sweet time, leading to pretty much nothing that I can infer.
And it's like one of the only episodes so far that hasn't ended with like some sort of like live band number of like music.
I thought that was an interesting bait and switch, because he does take us to the Bang Bang Bar, which we're used to things wrapping up there. And it's interesting because now we're like after hours, after everything's happened, and we get some creepy intimations about what Renault's talking about on the phone, and it seems like they're still in the business of prostituting women, and I think that's what's happening. If not, it's something a lot more sinister than that. What were your thoughts on that? Like, oh, whether that, so you have a phone conversation where he's clearly talking to someone about a third party's taste in women.
Yeah.
But it sounded potentially illegal.
Yeah, that whole section of what's happening in this season so far is like, I'm waiting for it to come together more, because it is very confusing to me as to what's happening with that. I don't know. It's just, it's funny that, you know, you'd mentioned about how there's a lot of scenes that are just like not, I don't feel like any scene in it is unnecessary, but there are definitely scenes that are left to like go on for longer than you are, you know, imagining it's going to happen. I'd say like one, for instance, I believe it's in the fourth episode when Dougie ends up at the casino, and you literally watch for at least like 10 or 15 minutes, it felt like, of him walking through the casino, seeing like some little image of like the red room above a slot machine, and then going to it, pulling it down, and winning a jackpot. And Lynch does not just show you this happening, like, and intuits that it happens more than one time. Like, he shows him going to like 5 or 6 or 7 different machines and winning the jackpot.
He just shows it happening over and over. It's not even like, you know, a different filmmaker who just wanted to do it would have showed him do it one time, and then he would have been walking out the front door with a big pile of money.
Yeah,
and to show he'd done this several times. Not only that, but we have this little old lady, almost bag lady type character, who's over in the corner. I think it's a little old lady, and is like putting money into the slot machine. And then she watches him. She's trepidatious. She doesn't play the right one. Then she plays the right one. Then she wins. And she does that a couple times herself too.
Yeah.
And what do they call him? They call him something. Mr.
Jackpots.
Mr. Jackpots. And so we also are getting the kind of view from the character David Desmalchian and a couple of the other characters who are watching all this on like the cameras, you know, and they come down after he's won, and he's just winning over and over again. Again, Lynch is getting at something. You're not entirely sure. Although I will say what's interesting there is it does show us one thing that's interesting is through the entire original show, Cooper was connected in some way to the spirits of the lodge. The giant, he was connected to, obviously he met, you know, the man from another place and, you know, let's rock and all that stuff. And he got lots of weird little messages there. He also was seemingly, you know, connected to some of these things. And he had a connection even before he gets to the Black Lodge. So now, like, the scene does a couple things, which it establishes that the Black Lodge or the White Lodge or somebody is still helping him. In a way, you know, it's like a visual image of the lodge, right? But it looks almost like a light that appears over the jackpots. But what it is demonstrating is at this point, We basically have figured out Dougie Jones is gone because we see him destroyed. We see Cooper comes back. He's in his suit. He's got the buzz cut and everything. And he is a different character. You know, yeah. We realize, okay, this is the Cooper that we knew. Evil Cooper survived, puked or choked up a hairball or something, yeah. And is sitting there, and then he's arrested after he crashes his car. So we are aware this is the Cooper that we knew, but I think what the scene does establish right off the bat is that he's not completely, he doesn't quite understand where he's at or what he's doing.
Right.
He doesn't even have basic, like, cues, but he's basically completely dependent on this supernatural angle.
Yeah.
So he does it long enough that we get, hey, there's something really wrong with this guy. Even with the help from the Black Lodge, he's not snapping right back into it. It kind of sets our expectations that, hey, don't expect Cooper. Like, otherwise we might think Cooper's in there, he's thick as thing. And I think this is my reasoning why I think that scene happens. I think Lynch is sometimes trying to compartmentalize feelings, but do it in a way that's organic so that he leaves some scenes open for other things. When Janie comes into the story, which is Dougie's wife, which we really don't even know he has a wife until he gets to home. And he's got a wife and a kid. I assume it's his kid. I'm not sure who Sonny Jim is. And the fact his name is Sonny Jim is hilarious.
Yeah.
But when he introduced the Janie character, at first I'm like, oh, okay. But I really like this character a lot.
Yeah.
I like her, and I like the way Naomi Watts is playing her. She's one of two brand new characters that at first I was kind of didn't know how I was going to feel about them. And I think that Lynch is, particularly in these last few episodes, has made them very compelling characters.
She's not just like a one note or anything like that. There's more depth to her than what you originally see when you first meet her character.
She's a frustrated wife. We get that even initially, and she seems like she's a naggy shrew at first, but then we realize she's really a pragmatic woman who's dealing with a guy who is just a mess. Like, he was a mess before he was Cooper. He must have been such a mess that she doesn't even really seem that surprised that he's come back mostly autistic. Like, she doesn't seem like this is that far out of, like, the daily.
It's not phasing her.
No, and not much does phase her. I mean, when you see the kind of thing she deals with, she goes at one point and orchestrates, like, this really shrewd business deal with these guys that are trying to extort money from her and her husband because of his infidelities, and she handles that where she dresses them down on, like, a kid's playground while giving the money. I'm only going to give you this much because really you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. You should be happy to get this. And you know, and that Jeremy Davies is one of the guys. This is a funny little casting where, you know, they're like, yeah, she's a tough chick.
Yeah.
After she walks away. And then she stands up to the police in this most recent episode when they come to question him about the car.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's interesting and kind of fun to see that. I'm wondering though what you think about that. Like, we've got Dougie. He has a family. I think this does kind of greatly change or shape the way the Cooper story is unfolding. Yeah. What do you think about Janie and Sonny Jim and everything that's happened with them so far?
I don't know. It's a weird, like, connection. Like, Cooper obviously feels some kind of connection with Sonny Jim.
Yeah, there's like, one weird moment where he's just sitting there, like, crying.
Yeah. And then there's another scene where he's, like, sitting up in his bedroom with him, like, clapping on the lights.
Love
with
that
him.
Scene. Great scene.
I love that, too. But it's funny because it's just – I like the whole, like, inclination around the Dougie Jones-Cooper element, like, especially when he's going to work. Like, pretty much his only vocal skills at this point are repeated phrases that he's heard other people saying, and he's saying them back to them. But I love the interaction of other people around him. It's like they have no – it's almost like Lynch is saying, like, how we don't see each other as people anymore. We're only, like, we're so wrapped up in our own egotism that we can't even see when somebody is, like, completely gone as a person.
Right, they're suffering in some, like, tangible way. They're completely adrift. They need your help. And, like, Dougie should be a giant warning sign for these people. But everyone's so concerned with their own things. You know, some people are worried he's going to rat them out because of shady stuff they're doing. And man, Tom Sizemore, who hired the like waxwork doll of Tom Sizemore to be in this movie? He looked rough. That seems to be a common theme. We're like, wow, that's been a few hard years.
That person is old looking now.
Yeah. Right. It's a kind of impressive. Naomi Watts looks pretty much about the same.
Yeah, she's managed to make it through.
So what I think is interesting about that story with his family, before kind of contrasting with the work thing, is you do have this portrait of, I think, what is like that kind of blue-collar kind of experience of someone who, you know, I've got my family life here, then right. I go to work, and these are kind of compartmentalized, you know, to a certain degree. And Cooper never really had – he had the work when he was Agent Cooper, but he was always kind of aloof. And even the relationships he had, we never – it seems like this might be an interesting way to explore a dynamic with Cooper. I think that these characters of both Sonny Jim and Janie are going to be important in some significant way with who Cooper becomes. So when we talk about identity, like pretty much Twin Peaks just deals constantly around identity. I mean, the big question is, the question in the very first season of the show was really, who was Laura Palmer? I mean, who killed Laura Palmer seemed important until we found out who did. And then it was like, well, what does that even mean? You know, the question really becomes, who was Laura Palmer? And that's what we really learned through the first season, more than who killed her was an aside later on. But really, we were learning about everything that was going on with her. We learned more about what's going on with her and what she's dealing with in Twin Peaks Fire Walk Me. Who is Leland Palmer is a question. You know what I mean? Like, the questions of identity, even who is Cooper, as we get into the second season and we find Wynda Merle is accusing, you know, like the reason Wynda Merle has an issue with him is because he had an affair with Wyndham's wife, you know.
Right.
There's just so much that we really don't know about people. And then, like you said, the identity question Lynch seems to be asking here is, how well do we even really know ourselves?
Yeah.
And what role do these black lodges or white lodges even play in that? Do they illuminate things? Do they just obscure things more? And Cooper comes back from this certainly not enlightened in any way, as far as I can tell. I mean, I don't think Lynch is going to have him suddenly remember all these great things.
Yeah.
I don't know that his experience in the Black Lodge has really been a revelation. You know, you're on the other side of life, in a sense, I suppose. And it doesn't seem to have equipped Cooper with any better skills. He just comes back like an alien who doesn't know how to, like, live in a human body. And he recognizes coffee. He recognizes the badges. There's that weird scene where, like, the lodge seems to be helping him again by telling him where exactly to mark and circle things on the documents. And
which is another, like, 7-minute scene.
Right. And so you sit there and you watch this, and I still feel this is like Lynch making some kind of statement. We've seen weird little creatures. We've seen these strange things. And yet here's this mundane way of the way the supernatural world speaks to Cooper. And it's at the beginning of the episode, it has him circling all the things and going through the reports and the forms. And then either in that episode or the next episode, the arm literally pops up out of the ground to him while he's fending off a guy, and it's telling him, squeeze off his hand! Squeeze off his hand! And
not to mention, like the weird piece of, like, skin that's attached to the gun after he disarms
him. That's because he did what the arm told him to. He squeezed his hand so much so that a piece of meat popped off on the gun. I'm not sure how that happens. And the creepy little midget guy who dwarf character who is referenced in the credits is like Ike the Spike or something like that. And he, you know, we watched him murder people in a horrible way in a terrifying scene.
A brutal scene
in one of the more recent episodes where we see him kind of picking his targets. And then we see this scene is actually probably a good scene to talk about in context with the office scenes of Dougie, because it captures that, like, weird morose, almost melancholy that comes with, like, office, that drab office setting. And then he does something that just completely disrupts it. In this case, this office that they're in doesn't look all that different than the office Dougie works in. But you see this shot of this woman in an office, and then there's the hallway, and all of a sudden people are screaming, and this little short little person runs around the corner with this, like, looks like a railroad spike, and just starts brutally, like, murdering someone with it, like, just chopping them up. And it's intense and crazy and creepy, and that's the scene stops there. And the next time we see him, he's running out of a crowd, this time with a gun, and he's got it pointed at Dougie and pointed at Janie, and she just jumps right in there, too. And then Dougie really seems to receive, well, he's not Dougie at all. That's the other thing about the identity question. This isn't Dougie. It's not Cooper. I have to keep reminding myself this, because what's revealed at one point is that Killer Bob is not Bob walking around in Cooper's skin, which is what I always thought.
Yeah.
It's the doppelganger that we saw in the Black Lodge has gone
that Bob's
out.
A part of.
And Bob is riding like a shotgun on the doppelganger, who is clearly driving it like he stole it. And he says something when he's in jail, you know, hey, I'm glad you're still with me. And this recognition that Bob is a part.
Well, you even see that scene where he's like looking in the mirror and you see like kind of an image of Bob. You see like a little bit of Bob like take over the face of him as well too. It's like very quick when
which
that
was,
happens too.
It's kind of a creepy little effect that they have going there.
Yeah.
But then when this guy, this assassin, runs out to kill Cooper, and this isn't the first time that Cooper, someone's tried to kill Cooper in this season.
Yeah.
There was one point when they tried to assassinate him right after when they seem to be working for Bob, Evil Bob, because they're waiting at the house when Cooper comes out. And we don't know if they're waiting for Dougie or they try to shoot him and he just happens to reach down. Interesting enough, what he reaches down to pick up is the Great Northern Key.
That's right.
That was in his pocket. So that's interesting because he finds it, he drops it, he goes to pick it down. That's the thing that saves him from being shot. And they also don't, not only saves him from being shot, but they don't know to follow him.
Yeah.
Because they don't see him in the car. So there's a whole bit involving the car, with Dougie's car, and Jane's always asking where it is, and it gets blown up. And all of that's interesting, but they just seem like red herrings to me for the most part.
Yeah.
Just stuff that Lynch is trying to add some connectivity to, but it's more like tissue and meat there. It's not meat. It doesn't seem like something that's going to pay off. I could be wrong. We also have a character who's reciting a couple of numbers in a room, in a house.
Yeah.
119, and it's like, well, what does that mean? Does it mean anything? I mean, you know, it's quite obviously 911 backwards, but then the little boy who lives with her goes out and comes across the street and is there when these like carjackers try to grab Dougie's car and they blow up. They like explode. And that's not the only action. That's not the only instance of like extreme violence. It's also one of the scenes that occurs involving a child. It's one of two scenes. We can talk about the other one in a minute. But to dovetail back, we see this assassin come. We've watched him do a brutal murder. He runs out, and we see him attack. And I'm worried at this point for Dougie's wife. But this is the point when the Cooper character does kind of reestablish itself in a very immediate way. And you almost feel like maybe he's back now. He seems to have a little more, at least to a certain degree, of back. He seems to have gained some level of awareness. And I wonder what he's thinking when he sees these manifestations. Because we haven't really had him speak. Like you said, outside of parroting things, he hasn't really said anything.
No.
He hasn't made his own statements. The closest we've seen to any kind of emoting are two things. One, him standing at the base of this, like, ranger statue that seems to be out front. And he just sits there all night long. And it's another long scene of him just sitting there forlornly holding the shoe or whatever. And he's so adrift, it's the only thing he, like, seems to be able to hold on to. And then we watch someone come and take him home and everything. And in it, he seems to be grasping to these straws of being an FBI agent. And we're either seeing this reestablished, but we're also seeing him start to grasp onto the straws of being a family man. So the new Cooper does seem that this bit of Dougie Jones, this family that Dougie had, is being integrated into who he is a little bit.
Yeah.
And I don't expect, in a different show, a different director, we might see Cooper come back and say, okay, bye, give Janie a kiss, thanks for the help, and then leave. Don't think that's what's happening here. I think there's... in fact, I got a weird history of violence. We're jumping weirdo directors here. But I got weird history of violence vibe from this scene where he disarms the assassin. Because he throat chops him, like, twice. And yes... And I almost wonder why we needed to see the arm screaming, squeeze off his hand! Because in every other way, it seemed to be a perfect thing of just Cooper instinctively being himself, being Cooper. It's like, he needs the weird mystical interventions for running, doing the reports and stuff like that. But it seems like he just is instantly, boom, back to instinctually like he was.
Yeah. Well, I think the Lodge is just a part of him now, So I think that like that's just going to carry through through the rest of the season too. But it's one thing that's funny that I was just thinking about when we were talking about this is, we're talking about identity and we're talking about how Cooper Dougie is starting to gain his identity back, while at the same time the Bob doppelganger, I think, is starting to lose its identity, because I think you see, even though he was always very weird and different from when we first been introduced him in this season, but I think ever since the when he was trying to get pulled back into the lodge, and he's like puking up the garambazia or whatever, I think since he went into prison, like there's something about him. His demeanor has completely changed. The way he's talking is completely different. It's just very odd and strange. And I think like he is slowly like losing, like he's trying to hold on to who he was to, stay from going back into the lodge. But I think he's losing his identity as well in that situation. Just his interactions with, Albert and Gordon, and then the last episode when we finally, meet Diane, and Diane goes to meet him. I think that you're seeing like there's this weird dichotomy between, the Cooper Dougie and then the doppelganger Bob.
And that's another interesting aspect, I think, of the identity thing, because I think you're right, but what I'm not clear of yet is whether or not the Bob that we've been seeing since the accident is the Bob that Bob's really lost anything. It may be, and I think this goes back to the scenes of Dougie at work. This is where we have that we have identity, but we also have the perspective and kind of expectation, and then how people see us. Because when we see Bob for the first part of this season, he's got a little bit of that like dog on the run, like or he like I think I referred to him as kind of like this hunted animal, he feels like his time is up and therefore he's more dangerous than he might be otherwise. But he's still sort of playing the role of like the got it in control evil dude, He has that like Randall Flagg sort of feel
I
when
can
he
totally
first
see that.
shows up. But then when he's in prison, he kind of like almost shuts down purposefully and becomes very kind of aloof. And part of it, I think, is we're seeing him through the eyes for the first time in the sh in this show. We're seeing him for the first time through the eyes of people who knew him when he was Agent Cooper. We haven't actually had him. There's a hint, as really dark hints. We'll talk about that in a minute, of some interactions he's had with Diane. I couldn't quite figure that. Maybe you can shed some light on what you think. We don't have a definitive answer. But when he talks to Gordon, I thought it was weird too. When he talks to Gordon, he says like Yver, like he says every backwards. He's like
Out of
every,
nowhere.
very, like right, which is weird because then Gordon Cole, I think that's the thing he latches onto, and Gordon Cole talks a lot about in the previous episode about things being backwards and mirror versions, and it, and I love. There's this great scene there when Cole comes out of that discussion, and it happens at the end of, I think, the fourth episode, right around the same time we meet in a totally different series of events going on in Twin Peaks, where we meet Wally Brando, which has got to be one of the weirdest scenes in the new show. It's not quite my favorite scene, but it is such a weird sequence. I really am not a Michael Cera fan, but I have enjoyed some of his weird like little. I don't I he didn't cut it for me as a lead actor, but I
No.
don't mind him showing up in these weird little cameos, particularly this one
Yeah,
and his
he's great in
weird
this.
kind of character. Like, there's not much I can even say about this scene that shouldn't just be experienced, and it almost exists upon itself. I gotta say too, man, you watched when you one of the things that Lynch is really good at is making you remember why and how much you like certain actors. I think Tarantino often gets credit for that. I don't think Lynch gets enough credit for doing the same thing. Like when he kind of reintroduced everybody to Richard Farnsworth in The Straight Story, or, like reminding us how creepy Dennis Hopper could be. And like Miguel Ferrer, who's now sadly is not with us anymore,
Oh,
like,
he's so great.
yeah, and he's really good in this. Like, I'm glad because you see him in a lot of stuff, and he's always the same kind of hard-boiled dude. I think he had an underrated Stephen King movie, I thought, called
Oh,
The
Night
Night
Flyer?
Flyer. Yeah,
Yeah, he's great in that.
we'll save that when we talk to Stephen King. But yeah, he was good in that. I always liked him. He was a fun kind of actor. But he's good here. I'm going to be disappointed at a point when we don't have him in the show anymore.
Yeah.
But there's that scene when they come out of talking to Cooper, and he's clearly not the Cooper. And both of them, both Albert and Cole pick up on this.
Yeah.
And they come out and they talk about Cooper Cole just says, I really have no idea what's going on. It's probably the first time you hear David Lynch actually admit, I have no clue what's happening. It's a little cathartic, but at the same time, you're like, yeah, well, newsflash. one of the bunnies is missing. Yeah. So, but I like that scene, and I think that we're watching him play off these people in a way where he doesn't quite know, I think, what he's dealing with, because I don't think for all the time he's been in Cooper, I think this might be what the show is getting at, he doesn't understand Cooper.
Yeah.
He's not in Cooper, he's in the doppelganger, but it doesn't seem like he has garnered or gained any real information about who Agent Cooper is as a person, so he doesn't really know what to do when he's faced with these people. So let me ask you, so we get Diane introduced in this kind of weird moment. Everyone's kind of wondering, who is Laura Dern going to be? Albert goes and he meets her. Someone put that picture up from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where Albert's saying, like, Diane, and then you've got that picture of, like, when Danny DeVito was playing the art critic, and he's got the white hair, and he's like, rawr! His face is all contorted.
I didn't even recognize Laura Dern the first time she showed up in the new season. I was like, who is that?
And then, but she's really good.
Oh, she's really good
as Diane. She has one of the strongest scenes in the show, again, in this last episode, playing off of... And this is the first time where I really have got this sinister feeling about Evil Bob. Like, I always felt sinister about him in the old show, but since he's been taken over the body, except for that scene where he's cracking his head against the mirror, there was never a moment... There was that scene where he kills Daria, but again, that kind of had that feeling of, like, oh, here's the evil hitman kind of character, and there's threat because he's got a gun at your head. But this was threat where she's sitting there talking to him. I mean, it was creepy in the same way that, like, Batman and the Joker and the Dark Knight is creepy. You know, you're watching him sit there almost emotionless, and he's referencing things. And what is your impression of the scene? Because she references, there's two events in this episode that made me kind of queasy to think about. One of them was this. We'll talk about this one first, though it's the second in chronology when it happens. We start to get a little more information about possibly what Bob Cooper has been up to since he took the body, because we really don't know much. Since he's assumed the personality is really what we should say. In a way, he's assumed Cooper's identity because everyone who comes in contact with him thinks he is Cooper. So when Dern asks a question, what happened the last time we met, or where were we the last time we met? Is she, because she suspects he's not Agent Cooper?
Yeah.
It seems like there are some people out there who have seen this, and some reviewers that are saying she's referencing a very dark event that happened after Bob Cooper came back, found Diane, and she had some potentially horrific night at the hands of evil Bob Cooper. Now, that's one way to read it. What did you think?
That's kind of what I took out of it. I felt like it was like almost some kind of like a rape situation that had happened between them. And we had not mentioned before, but if you have not seen the original series of Twin Peaks, is you never see Diane in the original season. So season one, season two, Fire Walk Me, you never see Diane. This is just somebody who Cooper is narrating, you know, his thoughts to in like a tape recorder, you know. So this is just kind of this faceless character throughout that time. So, you know, when you do see her in the new season, it's, you know, it's kind of a shock to see her, you know, because you've heard about her for so long vicariously through what Cooper's saying, you know. And the way that Cooper would talk to her in the tapes, you felt like they had like a good working relationship. But the Diane that we meet in this season is completely not what I was expecting Diane to be like. She is, you know, telling F you to everybody that she meets, even the new girl, Tam, you know, she gives her like 2 seconds to answer her and then F you too.
What's your name? Tammy. Oh,
well. Yeah. Well, F you, Tammy.
But what does Cole say? Now we've got the pleasantries out of the way.
Yeah. But there's something, like you said, you nailed it perfectly. There's something very like extremely like disturbing and sinister about that scene where she talks to Cooper. There's something about the lighting that they're using in these scenes in the jail when they're talking with Cooper. It almost, for me, it feels like at any moment you're gonna see like Cooper's face just drop off and like some kind of horrid monster be beneath it. It's like the idea of like the Men in Black, like the Edgar suit. It feels like there is an evil entity wearing the Cooper suit right now.
Like Steve Bannon.
Yeah, exactly. Just like Steve Bannon, just a little less of an alcoholic. But yeah, there's
this shell isn't in as bad shape as that one.
Yeah.
That cocoon husk is about to shuck off.
Yes.
In Twin Peaks, or in like the original show, like you said, there were some people who were like, "Oh, maybe Diane's all in his head," but I don't think that's what Lynch ever meant it to
No.
be. I just think he never got around to introducing her. There's a good reason to introduce her now. I think that you're probably right. One of the reasons is because Diane seems so harsh. She's so set against this idea of Cooper. But what I wonder is two things: is there's a part of her going there and encountering this Cooper that she is able to confirm this is not
Yeah.
the Cooper I knew. And it seems weird that if she had this crazy night that happened, now that depends on the particulars of the night, then wouldn't she have known back then it wasn't Cooper? Maybe she
Yeah.
would have like told somebody then, unless it was, like you say, some kind of perhaps sexual violence or something that happened immediately that seemed like Cooper had just turned on her and then was gone. Now, it
Right.
seems to me she may also be mad at the FBI just because Cooper disappears and no one ever locates him.
Yeah.
It seems that Bob could be lying when he says, "Oh, well, the night we'll both never forget,"
Yeah.
because it could be that what Diane is referencing is something that is maybe personal and specific to she and Agent Cooper. And
Yeah.
one of the two things that made me think that is her extreme emotional response when she comes out to Cole, which I thought was kind of a touching moment when he kind of gives
Yeah.
her what seems to be a legitimate hug. Cole's a weird character because Lynch plays him very affable and you kind of like him, but he seemed like there's this weird, and we haven't even talked about Denise coming back yet.
Yeah.
David Duchovny's character, talk about an identity again,
Yeah.
But there's that moment too where Cole is kind of like saying, "Hey, I went to bat for you, and I did things." But even Denise seems to reference he's a little bit of a horn dog,
Yeah.
and we kind of get that. There's at one point when Arthur calls and he's like, he and like Tammy seem to be like having a party in his room or something, and Arthur's like out in the cold,
Well,
like in the rain,
there's also that scene where Tammy's walking away
and
and
in
the
Lynch.
camera lingers on her.
And it's like Lynch literally just staring at her hindquarters. Yeah,
Yeah.
pretty much. But so there's a lot of that kind of like there are these elements of like of Gordon because I didn't he kind of have a crush on wasn't it Matt Chinamek in the original?
Yeah.
Who was it? And there it seemed a little bit more lighter and almost just like two like kindred spirits. But
Yeah.
it's almost that almost seems cast in a different light with where Denise is referencing. Yeah, we know you got a thing for like the
Yeah.
young girls, and it seems it's just weird. It's a weird sort of like detail to put in there, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sure Roger Ebert would have had a lot to say about that.
Yeah, probably.
But so it seems like maybe, then she says, "I'll tell you all about it one day," when he references the night in the
Yeah.
hotel room. And I wonder, and this is maybe me trying to use too much practical logic. It almost feels like, were she raped? Were she harmed in some way, maybe beyond an emotional betrayal by the Cooper character? I feel like that's something she might be more willing or upfront to tell him now. This,
Yeah.
hey, we'll have a conversation about it sometime, makes me wonder if this is not something that happened between her and real Cooper.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about it that way. That's definitely a good way to look at it. I think it's one thing I wanted to say is like Nathan and I said at the beginning of this, we're not going to be able to get through every single scene or every single thing that happened in there because there's so much going on here. But one thing I did want to bring up is it's funny. I think it's kind of strange how, like I said the last time, the world is much bigger in this season of it. It's not all just taking place within Twin Peaks or just the, close surrounding areas. This is like nationwide that this is happening. But it's weird when you go there's a stark, like, almost realism to the outside world of Twin Peaks, and then when you get to Twin Peaks, it's like the kooky, idiosyncratic, like, weird nature of some of these people. Like we said, Lucy is afraid of cell phones, and we have Wally Brando, and we have, Hawk running into, like, Glastonbury Grove, and, Bobby Briggs shows back up as a deputy who, like, spends a minute crying over a picture, an old picture of Laura Palmer for no reason. Like, he'd completely forgot about who she was. So I like the way that those two worlds are converging in a
Candy
way.
Clark showing up as the new Truman's wife, the
Yeah.
Robert Forrester character, which I want to talk about, but not quite yet. There are two ex you know you were saying that there are two, I think, very specific instances that play in contrast to what you just said, which I think is true otherwise. Like you said, you get the kooky, sort of almost down home kitschy world of Twin Peaks, the way it used to
Right.
be, like the comforting. There's a certain level of comfort there when we get back to that. And yet, there are two scenes that take place in Twin Peaks, too, that I can think of that have that very off putting, dark, gritty kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
And one of those is a scene that takes place with, it just sort of comes out of the blue, but it reintroduces the character played by Harry Dean Stanton,
Oh, yeah.
who looks like he's literally just chiseled out of like stone at this point in his career. Like, I'm amazed he is still chugging along.
He's always looked old.
He has. He's a, yeah, I mean, a repo man. I mean, it was like, he's like, he was like born from the womb at 84. And he. In the, he and the other guy, Emmett Walsh, they're both actors who,
Yes,
like,
yeah.
they never stop looking old and grizzled. And it's hard to gauge how long they've really been around, but I'm like, hey, I'm still glad that we have Harry Dean Stanton. And he has this extremely interesting and very kind of, like, interesting, kind of poignant scene, but it involves a character who seems to have the last name of Horn, this young guy. And the other scene I'm thinking of that's very stark is when he's first introduced at the end of season five, I think. A lot of these episodes, they end at the Bang Bang Bar. And do you know see him talking about? They introduce him. He's this young kind of hell-raising, like, young guy, but he basically threatens a girl. He grabs her and
Yeah,
throws
that's
her on his
right.
lap with a knife. Jane Levy's in the same scene. I don't know if we're going to see these characters again. But who is this? Like, we don't know who exactly this guy is, do we?
No,
But
I don't think so.
we do get like the my concern. I have a very specific concern about this guy. I think it's they've referenced that he's a Horn, and I thought he must be Jerry's son because Jerry high all the time. Yeah, that scene where he's out in the middle of the woods. I'm so high right now, and he's just standing out there crying. Again, David Patrick Kelly, a great actor who we
Oh,
don't
he's
see
great
nearly
in
enough
that.
of. And you've got Ben trying to talk to him. Ben gets a couple scenes in this most recent episode. Ben's trying to talk to him. Jerry's crying. He's like, I don't know where my car is. I don't know where I am. I'm like, well, if Dougie knew to say anything, he doesn't know where his car is either. And don't see him crying about it. He doesn't know where he is. But that was a cool scene. I love too how they integrate like the cell phones. And like not just the cell phones, but then they have a Skype call in the most recent episode. But to go back to this young character, I'm assuming he's Jerry's son, perhaps, some
That's
kind
what
of
I'm thinking, yeah.
relationship. But then there's something else, is that he's still pretty young, and Jerry's not young. If Jerry were to have a son, you'd assume he'd maybe be the same age as Audrey, a character who hasn't showed up yet. And this character, this young Horn, is a bad dude. Who is it? He has this whole conversation with. Is this the Ray character? Who? There's a character that gives him something. Do you know what I'm talking about? There's a scene where he's getting the drugs, but we're not. Who is that character? Because I'm still not entirely clear.
That's something where I'm just like, okay,
I'm just gonna
I'm
go with
hoping
it.
this is gonna like tie into something at some point,
But
'cause it's
in
very
between all this,
strange.
he basically runs down a young boy in his truck. And,
Which
or,
is a very startling scene. I
in
was not
someone else's truck.
expecting that.
No, and it's not so much the boy himself getting hit, which I didn't expect to see, but we see the truck run right over him. Again, it's one of the scenes is having a young child. It's very jarring for me. But it's actually what makes it heartbreaking are the lead up and the lead out of it is that
Yeah.
did Stanton, this is Stanton's really his only scene that he's had so far. And I think he is a character introduced in Fire Walk With Me,
Yeah,
right?
he was in Fire Walk With Me, yeah.
And so he is sitting there on the bench. He looks and he sees this young woman playing kind of like a little game of, a cute, innocent game of tag with her son. She'll run a little ways and he'll run a little ways and he's kind of smiling. And it's just a nice scene. You're like, oh, this is nice. It's nice to see a change of pace from all the dark garbage going on. And then he stops and we see the truck coming. I'm like, I know what's going to happen here. And he runs out and he gets run down. Then we see the whole, you know, the most of the town's just standing on the wayside looking at this. And where I'm like thinking to myself, this is probably one of the more horrible things that the people of Twin Peaks have seen probably since Laura Palmer.
Right.
And just blasts through, takes the kid out, keeps driving, tries to like wipe the garbage off the front of his truck later when he gets far enough away. He's remorseless about it.
Yeah.
But Stanton watches, like, I guess, kind of like the kid's soul or something kind of pull up out of his body, which was a very strange and, again, scene. But it hinted at kind of, you know, this element of these supernatural powers. It was one of the few, like, kind of positively supernatural scenes.
Right.
In a sense where it's like there's a little bit of, like, you know, I don't know what you're supposed to take away from it, but it's just interesting. And then we see the little boy's dead. And that was just a sad, a sad scene, a legitimately heartbreaking kind of a sequence. I don't know how Stanton's going to play into this story more, but that scene did intrigue me. And this other scene with this young horn. The reason I mention these two scenes is they are kind of where the grittiness comes in.
Yeah.
And then something happens that kind of, I don't know if it puts it together for me, but it makes me concerned. At the beginning of this recent episode, and ties in probably the last thing we want, unless you have something else that we can kind of talk about, and then I don't know if we have time. I got to talk about Jacoby and his shovels.
Yes, but we need to talk about that before we end.
Yeah, Jacoby and his shovels, and also we need to talk about the Amanda Seyfried character just a little bit.
Right, yeah.
She has one of the weirdest scenes visually,
yeah,
I think.
I really like that scene, too.
Yeah, me too. But before that, Todd, what do you think about the new Sheriff Truman?
I love him. I think he's great.
I
would like to see Harry. I don't think he's going to be in this series. I'm pretty sure he's not coming back, but he's perfect in this role. Like, you would think, like, he's going to, he almost looks like he's going to be like a hard ass, but he, you know, cause he's played some of those kind of characters before, but he's just very, you know, kind of sweet and genuine and just a really likable character. I think he's great in this role.
You know what it reminded me of a little bit? It's like Forrester's a character actor who was great way back in the day.
Yeah.
Then no one like saw him for years. And then like, Tarantino pulled him out of retirement in a way for Jackie Brown.
Right.
And that was Robert Forster, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. He was really good in that movie, and he also was kind of gentle in a way in Jackie Brown. And I kind of feel like this is like Lynch kind of bringing him back around again. Like, oh, here, have a little bit of Robert Forster. Because it's not like that last time really took, you know.
Yeah.
It was great to see him. And I feel like the kind of the work he was doing in that movie, in Jackie Brown, he was, it made you really sort of like him. Like you said, he's got that hard exterior. But he had a kind of gruffness, but a likability to him. And he has that here in Twin Peaks, which is why here he's Frank Truman. When he's playing off of, like, his wife, Candy Clark, she's being shrill and crazy. And I'm like, dude, I remember when she's talking about cat stealing baby's breath back in Cat's Eye. Or screaming at Michael Moriarty in Cue the Winged Serpent. And so she's here yelling at him. And just the way he even interacts and reacts to that in such a gentle sort of matter-of-fact way, you know.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. He has that Skype call with the doctor who's actually Mark Frost's, like, actual father. And I remember when he was in the original show. He's passed on now, too. So it is cool that Lynch was able to give so many of these characters who have died, like, roles. Like, they get to complete their characters, in a sense. So what the doctor reveals, before I talk a little bit more about Frank Truman, the doctor makes a kind of statement that stuck in my head and made me connect a few dots, which is he says that the last time anyone really saw Agent Cooper, he was leaving, they assumed, they don't know, but they assumed he was leaving Audrey Horne's room.
Yeah.
And Audrey, who was in a coma because of the events that happened at the bank. That That coupled with the initial, when I initially heard the conversation that Laura Dern had with him, where she says, oh, the night, what happened the last night we saw each other. And then remembering what kind of person, entity, whatever you want to call it, Bob is. Yeah. I mean, we know that Bob is, as Bob, as when he was in Leland Palmer, he raped Laura Palmer.
Yeah.
Leland talked about how Bob kind of molested him as a child.
Yeah,
we know
true.
That Bob has this kind of identity as this sort of sexual predator, amongst other things. And if he's visiting Audrey Horne in the hospital, that really can't be a good thing. And now there's a younger Horne that would be just about the right age to be Audrey's son and seems to be a relatively bad dude running around out there. So I'm like, is he the, like, offspring?
Yeah, it's possible.
I mean, it's a Lynch world. Anything's possible. I just throw it out there. But, I mean, I wonder. I don't know that these things are... One thing I thought was interesting, Heather Graham's character was so integral, I think, to the show. And then she's brought back up in Firewalk With Me a little bit. And here, in a really weird kind of case where Hawk finds the letter. And I thought it was... Lynch really does tie things together in a real way and is giving you actual answers to things. And then I was like, wow, the fact that the note straight up says good Cooper's is in the lodge and they actually take it for what it means, you know, like Frank Truman starts looking into, hey, maybe he's not who he says he was.
Dude, that's how you can tell like how crazy the show can be, because I completely forgot about that scene until you just said it.
But it's that's where the people that are waiting for this thing to start paying off old Twin Peaks. So, but what also says is that Annie and Laura have met in the lodge through dreams, but Annie appears to living Laura when she's still alive. The fact that Leland must have stuck these in the inside of a stall door is interesting in itself too, because is this Leland trying to protect information that's integral from Bob, or is this Bob hiding info? You know, we don't really know, and I don't think that the show's done with Leland either. So
no.
There's a lot of interesting bits, but what I thought was bizarre is they leave the detail about Audrey Horne in, they ask a lot of details, but no one asks whatever happened to Anne.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's very strange, because Anne was the person that he's with when they come out, so it's like, hey, that might be a person to contact. And then so he goes and he calls his brother. That was kind of a set. I thought Lynch is doing an interesting job. He does an interesting job when he needs little things to work in a show. So, like, Michael Onkian doesn't come back, but that was still a touching scene where he calls him to talk to him on the phone, and we're learning that, hey, you know what? Harry's not really doing that well. Like, we feel bad for him. I thought that was effective. A lot of it because of Forrester. But I feel like with Forrester, they're getting a character that's able to kind of bring... Right now, while Cooper's trying to figure out who he is and what's going on with him, you still need that kind of likable, good-hearted, we are going to get to the bottom of this character that the show doesn't really have right now.
Yeah.
Except for Frank Truman. I mean, this episode, he kind of steps up and becomes that anchor, I felt.
Yeah,
like,
no, I definitely agree.
And just the idea that we might get Forrester in this kind of central role, and like, I'm like, man, that's kind of exciting. The same way it's exciting to see Naomi Watts start stepping up as her character. And so Truman and Watts' character, Janie, they're two of my favorites, because I just didn't see that coming. I didn't expect to see, hey, they're really building something here. And what would it's been a long time since I watched the original show. The Bookshop Boys, or what was that? Do you remember that? That little like group of like almost like they had a weird feel of like these like detective kind of guys, this fraternity of guys fighting the evil in the woods.
Yeah.
Do you remember what they were called? Remember they were on, there's that one great shot where they all get up, they all stand in like a profile line together where you see like Hawk and the old doctor.
It was the Bookhouse Boys. The Bookhouse Boys.
There you go. And I forgot about that angle too. And so I'm curious to see if that element gets resurrected, because I feel like Forrester's character would fit right in to that kind of motif.
I think a few other things I wanted to bring up quick, and I'll run through these quick before we talk about Jacoby. We'll probably end on him. But in the most recent episode, I think it was with Ben in the Great Northern, where there was a weird
such a great scene.
Like, it was so like It was one of those like sounds that just made you feel uncomfortable the whole time it's going on. And they're like trying to figure out where the sound is coming from. Like, I don't know what that's gonna play into, but I feel like there's gonna be more from that happening in one of these next episodes or so. What were your
Yeah.
thoughts on that, Nathan?
Well, that whole scene, one thing, the fact that we're starting to see characters more than just one scene, like that we saw Ben Horn twice in the same episode, you know, it's like we've got to be getting close to moving a little bit forward here with some of this stuff. So I like that scene because, and also there's a new character there, and the Ashley Judd character. And that scene is so weird because we've seen her once or twice before. And there's a weird scene where she then goes home to her dying husband or something. Her husband seems to have cancer. And at first I wasn't sure. I was like, I didn't see who it was. I was like, wait, is this the old sheriff? Like, is this Harry? Like, and then I looked at him like, oh no, it's a different actor. What's going on? Like, why are you doing this to us, Lynch? Like, who is this guy? But this idea that, and you know, and she seems to be kind of like macking on Ben, which I have no really idea why. Like, Ashley Judd trying to, you know, but there's a lot about Ben that was ended on kind of cliffhangers, if you remember the show, that was just unresolved. Ben was in a weird place at the end of season two, and he went from being kind of a villain to being this weird sort of adrift character, and now he just seems like a kind of he, like right now he seems like kind of harmless old man in a lot of ways, but then the Great Northern Key comes back. But that scene with the tone is so. That is so classically like Lynch, but it's also classically Twin Peaks. Like that, if there's any scene in the show so far that I feel like would have been in the original show, it's that scene. They walk to one corner. Hey, it sounds like it's coming over here. Then they walk to another corner. And it might just be too that like Pacific Northwest ambiance that happens anytime you're in the Great Northern. Like if a Great Northern doesn't exist, they need to build it so people can go and stay there because I would. And they should play the tone, like when you go into the.
The only other thing I wanted to bring up, because I don't think we mentioned it yet in either of these episodes, is there is a quick cameo with is it Grace? I can never pronounce her last name, but she played Sarah Palmer, Laura's mother.
Where she's watching like lions mutilate a deer on TV or something.
I don't know what that scene is supposed to mean at all, but I love the way it was framed, where there was like a three-piece mirror behind her, and you're watching like the action from the TV screen take place in the three mirrors. Because like the shot's just focused on her sitting on the couch, but you can still see it reflected in these three mirrors behind her. I don't know what the scene's purpose is. I don't know if we'll ever see Sarah Palmer again, but I just thought that was I really like thought that was a visually cool scene.
And Sarah Palmer's not the only character, or the first, or the only character, returning character that we see, where we only really get to see her sitting there watching TV or something. Because of the Jacoby scene we're about to talk about, we see Big Ed's wife sitting
Nadine.
there, Nadine. I don't know where Big Ed is. I mean, I'm still waiting for him to show up. He's got to be showing up soon, I'd hope. But she's sitting there watching Jacoby's crazy rant. But before Jacoby, so we do have this character who is matching a mixed. Daughter, who is dating one of the most weirdest, creepiest looking actors, Caleb Landry Jones. Like, it looks like his face is one giant like cold sore. Like,
He's a walking herpy.
he does. Did you ever see him in a movie? He was in a movie called Antibodies. Did you ever see that?
Oh my God, I forgot about that movie.
And did he looks about the same?
Yeah,
Like, he
crazy.
looks gross. I'm like, what happened to your face? It's like you went bobbing for apples in like a leper's toilet. I don't know what, you know, what's going on. It's just he's weird looking, and I don't know why. And like, and she even wants to make out with him. It's creepy, but
He's a mix of like Vincent Gallo meets Malachi from Children of the Corn.
that's about right. He just looks like bad. Like, no offense to you, Caleb Landry Jones, but come
Come on the
on.
podcast.
Yes, please, please. We'll talk about your mouth disorder. Buddy's interesting. And then it's funny because we also see this scene where he tries to get a job. And he's trying to get a job with one of Bobby's old buddies. I
He
can't
has
think of
like
the
no
guy's
idea how to
name.
like put it like send in a resume.
And the guy though who's interviewing him is like, isn't it one of Bobby's old friends from the original show? And he's
so.
Like, he now he's got a company, and he's like tearing this kid a new one. He's like, no, and I'm trying to prevent you from not getting jobs in the future. And I like that scene, but
yeah,
the scene between he and Amanda Seyfried, where you know she seems to be bad girl territory. She seems to have something in common with Laura Palmer a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm a little concerned about that. And then that scene where she's sort of high, looking up in the sky, is like classically weird.
Oh, I love that scene.
David Lynch. That kind of like gives me some Wild at Heart sort of feelings.
Yeah.
Watching that, you know. And because there were a lot of scenes of people being high in that movie. I remember Diane Ladd like decking herself out like the Wicked Witch of the West or something. Or just wiping lipstick all over her face.
Yes.
But it was one of those weird, just tripped out scenes of way too close on a human face. What I think is strange, did you ever watch any Veronica Mars?
I know, I've never seen that show.
So, I don't think it's really a spoiler, because Veronica Mars is a show that, when it comes out, starts with a murder mystery of the main character's like best friend. And it's a young girl, she is killed and found, and she's like the popular one, the prom queen kind of mentality. And she has, of course, a very sordid backstory that everyone starts to learn about. That she's been involved in all these different things. And she's not the person that they thought she was. And she's the centerpiece of a murder mystery for about a season and a half. Sound like anybody we know, right?
Yeah.
And she was played by Amanda Seyfried. So that's kind of the weird thing now, where I'm like, I don't know if Lynch has taken this into account, but it's like, you're looking at her here, and it's like, even if there was no other thing to link her to Laura Palmer, there's that.
Yeah.
So that, and Amanda Seyfried has those very wide eyes. I think, you know, like Lynch is probably just like, let's hire her for her eyes. So there's that. And then we come to Jacoby. So we've watched him buy and paint shovels for like two episodes. And then we have like the payoff of this. Talk about that.
One of the probably the greatest payoffs I've seen from something I had no idea where it was going to go from, because I mean Jacoby's always been weird, and we literally have long scenes where nothing is really happening other than him receiving shovels and then painting shovels, and then all of a sudden, out of like nowhere, he turns out that he's like now doing some sort of like underground like vlog show or radio show. It reminds
he's like
me
a
like,
podcaster.
Yeah, he's basically. Like a podcaster. And he's like it's like a mix of like InfoWars meets Coast to Coast AM.
Yeah, basically. And, it's all conspiracy theories.
He's going on these rants, and then you find out what the purpose of these shovels are, is he's selling them as golden shit digging shovels to dig yourself out of the shit of life for $29.99.
And not only does Lynch show him down in a pit with his crap-digging shovel, he pops up online with like a number to call to order your $29.99 shovel, and he's screaming, you know. And the stuff he's saying, though, I'm like, man, he's like, oh, they've done it again, those. I'm like, dude, you could be talking about the creators of this show.
Yes.
It's like, it's one of those very weird meta moments. But like, and he almost looks like he's channeling like Michael Parks and Tusk.
Yeah, oh, that, no, I totally got the vibes from that. He's like dressed up in like a big hat with like the wide glasses that he wears. It's crazy.
And let's not forget that Michael Parks was also in Twin Peaks. He was one of the Renault brothers. He was one of the Renault brothers in the first, in season two.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. I did not know that.
Right, it's all twisted up in a big pretzely knot. But and this is the scene where Nadine is watching him, so it's like we don't even need that to pay off to anything else. Just the scene of him with the golden shovel digging the, and this is what I mean, it's like, it's just like you said in the very beginning when we talk about this, is very much about the journey. We're building the characters. We have that feeling, that questions of like identity, which who are we? What makes us? I am wondering if, because season two went down so many different rabbit holes in the original series, and we got this emphasis that I never really saw Lynch emphasize as much, which Lynch enjoys the supernatural, but I think he likes more the mysterious than the supernatural, meaning he likes to throw out these very weird existential ideas, but I don't know that he is that interested in paying them off in a, such a way where we learn exactly what's going on. Season two had a lot of talk. I mean, he even started talking about UFOs at one point, you know? I mean, at one point, did Bigfoot murder Laura Palmer, you know? I mean, there was pretty much every theory under the sun. And And the show started to really like delve into these like Native American mythologies and stuff like that. And there's a part of me that wonders if the show will ever do that again. I don't think it needs to, but I do wonder where all of it's going exactly. But I'm fascinated by what's there, which I think is impressive, is that you have so many different threads, like we've talked about, and he keeps them moving, and he is starting to coalesce them now. I think that he, like the guy sweeping up all the crap in the Bang Bang Club, Lynch has got it all in a big pile now. We're going to see what he does with it.
Yeah, it's hard to believe we're already 7 episodes in, and we only got, what, like 11 more to go, I believe it is.
I think we did it. Like, I think we've managed a couple of things tonight, which is what we managed in an hour and 20 minutes. I think we got through episodes 3 through 7 enough for my liking, and I think we're caught up. So I think now what we'll do is maybe we'll just do every 2 weeks, every 2 episodes. But I'm really excited about where it's going. Any last thoughts you have, Seth?
I think I've wrapped it up for my portion.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We will be back with another episode of the Twin Peaks show in 2 weeks after episodes. I guess we're now on what, 8 and 9?
Yeah.
So I think we're headed in. We're looking forward to seeing how we're going to pay off the actual return of Cooper. I'll leave you with this one thought. There's a scene that's almost unlike most things I've seen in Lynch's movies, where we have this interview of people that are at the scene when Dougie Jones disarms.
Yeah, it comes out of nowhere.
The assassin. It does come out of nowhere, and I wondered about that. And you remember I made a reference to History of Violence, which was the David Cronenberg movie about where Viggo Mortensen plays a small town man who has been a assassin at one point, who was kind of hiding out, and a moment of violence recalls him back into his old life in a way.
Yeah.
But you know what also happens is people see him on TV. And that's how they know to go looking for him.
Yeah,
that's
what
draws them to him. And there's a scene where this gal says something that, to me, is not very Lynchy. Like, it sounds like something you see in some kind of bad action movie or something. It's like, Dougie Jones, he was like a coiled cobra or something like that, you know, or striking cobra. And I'm like, such a weird thing. But Dougie's there. He's on television. Is this possibly how maybe Hawk or someone else or even Frank might find him? Be aware that because we know that Gordon Cole and Albert know that he's out there, but they also believe they've got the wrong guy. And now that Diane has confirmed it for them, they're pretty certain this isn't Cooper. So is this possibly the way through which Cooper is going to be recognized, that he's still out there?
That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it was just I think it was just drawn to attention because of how almost. That's a scene you see in some other movie where it would be done solely for the point.
It's not even filmed in the same way
at
all.
It's filmed
completely different.
Right. And it's the kind of thing that normally would happen in a movie just so, oh, look, he's on television, you know?
Right.
And it's going to be a point for someone to see him. And every once in a while, I think Lynch does something like that. Your typical throwaway narrative hijinks. So I don't know. Interesting. But Seth, thank you so much for joining me tonight for this, and I look forward to future installments. I'm also curious to see what the evil doppelganger of the arm is up to, since it seems to be out there in the world somewhere. It's probably terrorizing a Chuck E. Cheese somewhere.
Hiding in a ball pit.
Yeah, right. Right, one of the balls just starts yelling in your ear.
Tear their faces off.
Smash off his arm.
Get the cheese pizza while you're here.
Punch that mouse in the face. All right. Good night, everyone. Take care.